Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening number, I'm So Excited, brought to us by the Pointer Sisters. And we'll be hearing a lot more about 80s, girls, pop rock later on in today's program. It'll close it out as well. Today's featured genre today is dedicated to John Mazur of Palm Springs, California. 80s girl pop. Hope you like this, John. And now these transitions. Our first transition piece comes to us from The Week magazine, September 16, 2011. The operatic tenor hailed as the next Pavarotti. This is Salvatore Lisitra, 1968 to 2011. As a teenager, Salvatore Lisitra worked as a graphic artist in Milan, but his real passion emerged when he sang along with the radio. Hearing that, his mother urged him to get voice lessons, which he began at the age of 18. Despite that late start, Lisitra rose to become one of the world's most sought-after operatic tenors, considered by many to be an heir to his great countryman, Luciano Pavarotti. Lisitra vaulted to world stardom with a splash in May 2002, said the New York Times. Pavarotti was scheduled to sing two performances of Puccini's Tosca at New York's Metropolitan Opera, but he claimed illness and canceled. The Met's general manager, Joseph Volpe, had Lisitra flown in to New York on the Concorde as a last-minute stand-in. His big Italianate sound and full-voiced high notes, reminiscent to some of Pavarotti's own, earned him cheers after his arias and an extended standing ovation at the end. There's an element of dreadful irony to Lisitra's tragic early death, said the London Telegraph. Motorbikes were his abiding offstage passion, and he died as the result of head injuries incurred when his motorcycle slammed into a wall in Sicily. Now we'll never know Lisitra's full potential. He had a superb voice and relished the more muscular end of Pavarotti's repertoire. In the end, it may be neither fair nor meaningful to write on his tombstone that he was the next Pavarotti in waiting. He was simply him. That ought to be enough. And our regular transition section, Today in Music History, and today is the weekend of September 30 and October 1, brought to us by ThisDayInMusic.com and MusicOrb.com. If you were born on September 30, you share a birthday with Johnny Mathis. He was born on September 30th, 1935. Frankie Lyman, Why Do Fools Fall in Love, born on September 30th, 1942. And Sylvia Peterson of the Chiffons, He's So Fine, September 30, 1946. Or if you were born on October 1, you share a B-Day with Vladimir Horowitz, the pianist, 1904, October 1. Julie Andrews, Sound of Music, October 1, 1935. And Scott McKenzie, If You Come to San Francisco, October 1, 1944. Deaths this weekend in music history include 1977, Mary Ford died from cancer after being in a diabetic coma for 54 days. Her husband was Les Paul. Miscellany in music history this weekend. You may remember it was this weekend back in 1791 that Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute, premiered in Vienna. And back in 1950 this weekend, radio's Grand Ole Opry is broadcast on TV for the very first time. Back in 1956 this weekend, after test audiences gave a negative reaction to Elvis Presley dying at the end of the film Love Me Tender, the King was called back to reshoot the scene. In the new ending, the hero lives. In 1967 this weekend, it was thieves breaking into Mick Jagger's London flat and stealing jewels and furs belonging to his girlfriend, Mary Unfaithful. Back in 1970, 3 years after that, Jimi Hendrix was buried at the Greenwood Cemetery in Seattle. Among the mourners, Miles Davis, Eric Burdon, Johnny Winter, and members of Derek and the Dominoes. And finally, back in 2007, country music singer Keith Urban crashes his motorcycle on the way to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. The 39-year-old, who was not injured, said he was being followed by a photographer when the accident happened near his home in Sydney, Australia. And we haven't forgotten our trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from Uncle John's Bathroom Leader, Plunges into Music 2007, and Buzzle.com. Question number one, this musical performer worked at the Playboy Club before hitting it big with the song Heart of Glass. Who was this artist? Was it A, Pat Benatar, B, Mark Thompson, C, Debbie Harry, or D, Ted Nugent? Hint, this person was the lead singer for a band called Blondie. And question number two, which musician wrote the song Marriage of Figaro? Was it A, Mozart, B, Tiny Tim, C, Gershwin, or D, Pavarotti? Hint, it's not the person singing this song. So who was it that wrote the song Marriage of Figaro? Well, the answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. In local rock news, we see this article by Ed Condren, News and Observer, September 9, 2011, entitled Jonathan Bird Can't Stop Writing About His Home State. If any recording artist has the right to write about North Carolina lore, it's Jonathan Bird. The veteran tunesmith and lifelong Tar Heel, who was born in Fayetteville and lives in Hillsboro, is a seventh-generation North Carolinian. For our family, it all starts here in 1795, Bird says. James Bird started it for us in Caswell County back then. Maybe we go back even further, I don't know, but yeah, I know a thing or two about North Carolina. Bird's latest album, Cackalack, was released in January. The disc, which showcased on 9/11 at the Museum of Art here in Raleigh, is primarily made up of tracks that touch on the history and heritage of North Carolina. Wild Ponies is dedicated to the horses that live in Corolla on the Outer Banks. I Was an Oak Tree is the story of an English oak tree that helped make a boat that was shipwrecked off the coast of North Carolina. I love North Carolina, Bird says in a call from his Hillsboro home. My North Carolina was always a very physical place. It's a wonderful state that I enjoy writing about. It's a very inspiring place. But his home state didn't completely shape Bird. Prior to a visit to Ireland in 1997, Bird, 40, mostly played and listened to rock, classical, and jazz. Then, when I was exposed to another kind of music, things changed for me, he says. I started playing traditional Irish tunes, and then I started going really old school and played around with old country. It's a sound I'm really comfortable with. That comfort is apparent. Bird has found a niche, crafting moody and moving western-sounding songs with his voice, guitar, and fiddle. This next article was published in Slow Travel Berlin on August 21, 2011, entitled Wyndham Wallace Shoots the Breeze with Pianist and Composer Dustin O'Halloran. If you've seen Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, you may already be familiar with Berlin-based Dustin O'Halloran's exquisite solo piano music. The American contributed a number of pieces to the film's soundtrack, including the haunting Opus 23. A member of the band Devix, he has released two albums of piano solos, Volumes 1 and 2, under his own name, as well as the slightly more elaborate Lumiere, and a live album recorded in Berlin's Grunewald Church, Vorleben. One of the most exciting of his new wave of post-classical artists, O'Halloran specializes in sparse but beautifully melodic compositions that linger long after they've passed. Wyndham Wallace speaks to him about his work and his love for the German capital. The article skips down and ends with these questions and answers. You've been diagnosed with synesthesia. Could you explain what this has meant to both you and your music? Were you always aware of it? I was always aware of it, but never really understood. It was a kind of condition that many shared until I did some research on it. I started reading a lot about Kandinsky and composers like Messiaen and Schoenberg, who all shared this as well, and it made me realize this really distinct connection between painting and composing. I think it made me more comfortable with how I visualize and see music. Painting has always been a big influence on my work, especially the work of Rothko. Your first commercially released music was with the band Deviks, but your more recent solo work reveals a deep love for minimalist classical music such as Debussy and Chopin. Did you come to this kind of music late, or was your love for it always there? I always loved this music, and even from the beginning of Deviks, I always worked in private on the piano. My first instrument was the piano, and my first love of music was classical, so I guess I'm just coming full circle. Well, what provoked you to move from dream pop to solo piano work? This was never a decided move. I had always worked with piano, though mostly just in private. When I moved to Italy, it was the first time I had a chance to focus on it and actually record some pieces. You weren't classically trained as a pianist, I believe. What brought you to the piano, and how do you think your lack of formal musical education has affected your work? Well, I had a few years of lessons when I was young from a church organist. Nothing crazy, no conservatory, but I always had a love for the instrument. I think my lack of education has been a good thing creative-wise, but now I'm doing my own studying to catch up on skills I missed out on. Do you think the piano has a special ability to communicate timeless emotions? And do you miss playing the guitar during live performances instead of being seated behind an instrument, side on to the audience? Well, perhaps that's the reason. Is it really one of the few solo instruments that represent all the scales of music and can be so diverse? It's the one I feel most connected to. I do love guitar, though. I recently got to play again when Deviks were invited to do 4 shows in China last October. It felt good to hit a distortion pedal again. You've now worked on 3 movie scores, including Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette. How does this differ from creating music for your albums, and which is preferable? I think it's quite different to work on film scores than your own music, but I enjoy both in different ways. With film, there is always some kind of structure already laid out, and sometimes even a tonal idea. Do you consider the word sentimental to be an insult if applied to your music? No, not really. However people want to feel is okay. I've been known to be sentimental at times. Your music has a very meditative, calming quality to it, and yet it's not been accused at any point of falling into the New Age camp, as, for instance, George Winston was. Where does one draw the line between what is and what isn't New Age, and is it even important? Well, this is a funny question. Some other people have talked about this. I guess New Age was more aligned with spiritual healing or something. I think I'm more involved in composition in the way composers are. But if people feel calm when listening to my music, that's fine with me. I listen to Bach all the time to calm down. So, what do you know about today's featured genre? 80s girl pop music. Well, according to such sources as Wikipedia and Daniel Workman, Sweet101.com, we see that A girl group is a popular music act featuring several young female singers who generally harmonize together. Girl groups emerged in the late 1950s as groups of young singers teamed up with behind-the-scenes songwriters and music producers to create hit singles, often featuring glossy production values and backing by top studio musicians. In later eras, the girl group template would be applied to disco, contemporary R&B, and country-based formats, as well as pop. History. During the Music Hall Vaudeville era, all-girl singing groups were mainly novelty acts, singing nonsense songs in silly voices. One of the first major exceptions was the Boswell Sisters, who became one of the most popular singing groups from 1930 to 36, with over 20 hits. The Andrews Sisters started in 1937 as a Boswell tribute band and continued recording and performing through the 1940s into the late 1960s, achieving more record sales, more Billboard hits, more million sellers, and more movie appearances than any other girl group to date. This is from John Sforza, the Swing It, the Andrews Sisters Story, University of Press of Kentucky, published in 2000. 1970s to mid-80s, this was Patti LaBelle, and the Bluebells was a U.S. 1960s girl group. In the early 70s, manager Vicki Wickham helped remake their image, renaming the group LaBelle and pushing them in the direction of glam rock. LaBelle was the first girl group to eschew matching outfits and identical choreography, instead wearing extravagant spacesuits and feathered headdresses. Later, during the disco craze, female acts included Sister Sledge, Silver Convention, and Baccarat. Then other groups later took advantage of the disco backlash and brought girl bands into pop and pop rock from the mid-80s. Among the most successful of these were Bananarama, Pointer Sisters, Weather Girls, Mary Jane Girls, and the Bangles. During the 1980s, female pop music groups, including Pointer Sisters, Bangles, Go-Go's, and Bananarama, sang catchy pop music songs, but scored only three top ten hits. While Madonna led many breakthroughs for female soloists during the 80s, all girl bands of that era didn't garner the same degree of enduring support from their fans. Only 12 female musical groups or duos placed on the Pop Culture Madness Survey, which polls for the most requested songs from 80 to 89. The Pop Culture Madness database tracks fan demand for pop songs, updated with current requests to ensure an accurate snapshot of the most popular hits for each year tracked in the survey. A handful of these female group performers turned out to be one-hit wonders, yet some accomplished pop music culture first, including the number one hit It's Raining Men from 1983, while the Bangles were the first all-woman band to write their own tunes, play their own instruments, and top pop music charts. These milestones paved the way for much bigger success stories for girl pop bands like the Spice Girls, starting in the mid-80s, and more recently, the Pussycat Dolls. The Go-Go's are an all-female American rock band formed in 1978. They made history as the first all-female band that both wrote their own songs and played their own instruments to top the Billboard album charts. The Go-Go's rose to fame during the early 1980s. Their debut album, Beauty and the Beat, is considered one of the cornerstone albums of the new wave, breaking barriers and paving the way for a host of other new American acts. When the album was released, it steadily climbed the Billboard 200 chart, ultimately reaching number one, where it remained for six consecutive weeks. The LP sold in excess of 3 million copies and reached triple platinum status, making it one of the most successful debut albums ever. The Go-Go's have sold more than 7 million albums. We Got the Beat, which is playing in the background now, is a song recorded by the Go-Go's, written by the group's lead guitarist, Charlotte Caffey. The band recorded the song in 1980. The following year, the Go-Go's re-recorded the song for their debut album, Beauty and the Beat. Released in January of 82 as the album's second single, We Got the Beat, became the Go-Go's biggest hit, spending 3 weeks at the number two on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100, behind Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, I Love Rock and Roll. It was during the song's time that in the top U.S. 10 that Beauty and the Beat topped the U.S. Billboard 200. Clocking in at only 2.5 minutes, the song is instantly recognizable by its drumming intro. Lyrically, the song is a simple ode to dancing to a good beat, hanging out, and looking cool. We Got the Beat was named one of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. And then there's the Pointer Sisters. They are an American pop R&B recording act from Oakland, California that achieved mainstream success during the 70s and 80s. Spanning over three decades, their repertoire has included such diverse genres as pop, disco, jazz, bebop, blues, soul, funk, dance, country, and rock. The group had its early origins when sisters June and Bobby Pointer began performing in clubs in 1969 as Pointers, a pair. The line up grew to a trio when sister Anita Pointer joined them. The trio grew to a quartet when sister Ruth joined in December of 72. The group achieved its greatest commercial success as a trio during the 80s, consisting of the lineup of June, Ruth, and Anita. Bonnie had left the group in 1978 to commence a solo career with only modest success. Over the next few years, they achieved their greatest commercial success and continued to demonstrate their versatility. In 1980, the soulful pop single, He's So Shy, reached number three on the charts, and the following year, a slow, sultry ballad, Slow Hand, reached number two. The follow-up, Should I Do It, was classic girl group. The first release from this new union was American Music, a patriotic-themed, modernized take on the girl group sound, while I'm So Excited, which is playing in the background right now, was an influential, frenetic dance track. Actually, this opened today's program. It's not playing there right now. All these singles were significant hits in the U.S. and Australia. In 1983, the Pointer Sisters released what became their biggest-selling album ever, with Breakout. In 1984, they achieved four Billboard Hot 100 top 10 singles in a row. Automatic reached number five. Jump for My Love, which is playing in the background now, reached number three. A remix of I'm So Excited was added to the album almost a year into its shelf life and reached number nine. And another single from the album, Neutron Dance, also featured on the Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack, reached number six. '80s girl pop. Thank you, John. This next article comes to us from RollingStone.com. Readers poll the best songs of the summer 2011. It may not officially be fall until September 23rd, but by our count, summer is over. It was a time of crappy blockbuster sequels, massive U2 stadium concerts, Michelle Bachmann's rise and fall as a serious presidential candidate in earthquakes and hurricanes that seemed to foretell a coming apocalypse. Somehow we survived it all and now can look back with instant nostalgia. We asked you to vote for your favorite songs of the summer, and here are the results. This article's by Andy Green, by the way. Coming in at number 10, Maroon 5 featuring Christina Aguilera, Moves Like Jagger. Number 9, Adele, Rolling in the Deep. Number 8, Good Charlotte, 1979. Number 7, Lady Gaga, Edge of Glory. Number 6, Red Hot Chili Peppers, The Adventures of Rain Dance Maggie.
Look like someone drugged me, they wanted to unplug me. No one here is on trial, it's just a turnaround and we go.
Red Hot Chili Peppers. Coming in at number 5, Panic at the Disco, Ready to Go, Get Out of My Mind. Number 4, Coldplay, Every Teardrop is a Waterfall. Number 3, Foo Fighters, Walk. Number 2, Foster the People, Pumped Up Kicks. And number 1, Britney Spears, I Wanna Go. This contest wasn't even close. Britney won by a landslide, which shouldn't come as any surprise. The woman works with the most successful pop songwriters in the industry. So how'd you do on those trivia questions today? Well, let's start with answer number 2. Answer 2, the musician who wrote Marriage of Figaro was Mozart. That was answer A. And answer number 1, the singer who worked at the Playboy Club before heading up the group Blondie and hitting it big with the song Heart of Glass was Debbie Harry. Deborah Harry. Answer C. And she and her group Blondie will be closing out today's program with Heart of Glass. This final article was published in the News and Observer on the 13th of September 2011, entitled Jeff Beck to Perform at iHeart Radio Festival. Clear Channel Radio announced Monday that guitarist Jeff Beck will be a special guest at the iHeart Radio Music Festival, the 2-day music event in Las Vegas hosted by Ryan Seacrest that will mark the biggest live concert festival in radio history. Beck will join Steven Tyler to kick off the second night of the festival on September 24th. First known as a guitarist for the Yardbirds, a seminal English rock band of the mid-60s, Beck was ranked number 14 in Rolling Stone's list of greatest guitarists of all time. He joins a lineup of music superstars including Lady Gaga, Jay-Z, Coldplay, Kenny Chesney, the Black Eyed Peas, Tyler, Alicia Keys, Jennifer Lopez, Carrie Underwood, Jane's Addiction, John Mayer, Rascal Flatts, Bruno Mars, and Kelly Clarkson. We've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. If you have a suggestion for an artist, group, or genre of music to feature on this program, please leave a note for me, Randy Thompson, at 832-5138. So long until next time.